The words we read earlier from chapter 8 of 2 Samuel might seem little more than a piece of maybe interesting history from thousands of years ago. We're told about battlefield victories that have long since been lost in the sands. We're told about international arrangements, agreements. We're told about governments and how they were arranged. We're told about how David established himself as the king of Israel. And that's all very interesting. But what is it to do with us? Well, we have to start with a phrase that the writer of this part of the Bible uses twice in this chapter. It's once in verse 6 and it's once in verse 14. And he says this: "The Lord gave David victory wherever he went." This chapter has a set of summaries which hide a large amount of detail. Each of these wars, each of these battles, a lot of things happened in them. No doubt there were all sorts of stories that could have been told from these wars. No doubt there could have been all sorts of political stories about the negotiations that went on. All sorts of stories about who was appointed to where in the government and how they got there, how Joab became in charge of the army or whatever. But when this part of the Bible was written, we were just given sort of a broad overview in a few words so that then the writer could say, "The Lord gave David victory wherever he went." This is a chapter that is all about, in a way, strangely enough, what God did. We've read all sorts of things and we read them and it appears to be about what David did. But ultimately it's about what God did, what God is like, what God has done. At this point in time that we're reading about, David was the king of Israel. But Israel wasn't a very large country. I glanced quickly at a map and just tried to measure across, and my measurements came to something like 80 miles from east to west, 180 miles from north to south. And it's not a perfect square, the country he ruled over, so there were thinner points in the land where you'd have less than 80 miles going across. And this small country had some really terrible neighbours, some aggressive, some brutal neighbours. Imagine just yourself in a house on a street, and imagine that all the neighbours on that street around you, the people who live next door and the people who live behind you and the people who live opposite you, imagine that all of them were against you and all of them were always causing you trouble, and some of them were forever breaking in your house whenever you went out. And it felt like that to be in Israel. Around Israel were these other countries, and they were always causing problems for Israel. They were always trying to steal from Israel. They were always trying to kill the Israelites because they hated them. Many of them had never approved of the Israelites coming to live in this land in the first place, centuries earlier, under Moses and Joshua. A number of them had tried to attack the Israelites en route when they were coming to the land of Canaan. And then, during previous centuries and decades, during the days of the judges, such as Samson, those surrounding countries had constantly exploited Israelite weakness to take control over them. You flick through the book of Judges in the Bible, which tells the story, and you find one foreign king after another taking it in turns to dominate Israel. You get the king of Aram, he rules them for 8 years. You get the king of Moab, who rules them for 18 years. You get the king from the north, from Hazor, who oppresses them for 20 years. You get the Midianites, who rule them cruelly for 7 years. The Ammonites, the Amalekites, the Edomites, and of course the Philistines, all bullied, all harassed, all ruled, all attacked Israel at one point or another. And we could go on. The point is that the Israelites living in this little piece of land had people all around them who didn't like them and who were quite prepared to do what they liked to them if they could get away with it. And they didn't play by any rules. The invading armies that raided into Israel didn't come in sort of politely to win a victory and take control. They were brutal, they were vicious. Again and again we're told that the Israelites cried out for help to God because they were under so much pain and distress from what was going on. They were brutally attacked, their goods were stolen and their lives made miserable. We're told, for example, in the days of the Midianite invasion, that the Israelites became so troubled they had to run and hide in the caves. They couldn't stay in their own houses. They found clefts in the mountainside. They looked for strongholds because the Midianites were so oppressive to them. As I say, you imagine living on a street and the house in which you live, one side, every time you go out, there's somebody who just shouts abuse at you. And if you walk down the street the other way, there's somebody who attacks you. And if you go in your back garden, there you find that your back door neighbour is in there stealing everything out of your shed. And you look across the road, and there's just faces opposite who are just looking at you with contempt and wishing you were dead. That was the kingdom that David became the king of. Now, with such a history in the recent past, and with all David's own experience of fights and battles in the surrounding territories, what do you think David want to do? Now he's king of this country, what will he want to do for it? You know he would want to make that land permanently secure. He'd want to make it free from trouble, safe, peaceful. You'd want to, if you were living in that house, get rid of those neighbours and find they caused you no more trouble, that you could live at peace. And that's what we have in this chapter from the Bible. We're shown here David moving across the country in one direction and another. Now clearly that would have taken time, it didn't all happen in a week. But he's taking action on every border of his land to defend his people, to put down these vicious and cruel neighbours. King Saul in his time had already fought many of them, the previous king, and in some instances he'd beaten them, but he'd never won those decisive victories that stopped the trouble. But David did. He was determined to do so, and God helped him to do it. And we've seen previously in chapter 7 why... And we see previously in chapter 7 that God had promised he would do that. He promised to bring peace and security to his people, to those who trusted him. God says in the previous chapter, I will provide a place for my people Israel and will plant them so they can have a home of their own, no longer be disturbed. Wicked people shall not oppress them any more as they did at the beginning and have done ever since the time I appointed leaders over my people Israel. I will also give you rest from all your enemies. It was a great promise, wasn't it, for those people to have from God. It would be a great promise for any of us to have, to feel that we could go and live somewhere and be at peace and be safe and be secure, be caused no more trouble. That's the promise that God made to David, to the Israelites that he ruled over. And in this chapter we're reading about the cash value of that promise. Let's just see some of the fights David was involved in. First of all, we're told that David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. Philistines were the Israelites' old enemies. They were down in the southwest of the country. They lived along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And the difficulties with the Philistines went back over many generations. And of course, it was in battle with the Philistines that the previous king had lost his life. King Saul had been slaughtered by them. And David's best friend, Jonathan, had been murdered by them as well. But back in 2 Samuel 5, we were told how David won an outstanding victory over them. He beat the Philistines with the help of the Lord. And now we can just be given this one-liner in this chapter, that he subdued this aggressive people. It tells us that he took Metheg Amar from them. We don't know what that means, but whatever it actually means, what's clear is that David so crushed the Philistines, so overcame them, so decisively beat them, that they weren't going to be a problem again to him. He subdued them. He brought them under control. He brought peace on that side of the country. And then in verse 2, we're told that David defeated the Moabites, enemies who came from the southeast of Israel, so the other bottom corner. You may remember that David himself was related to the Moabites. His great-grandmother was Ruth. She was the wife of Boaz, and she came from the country of Moab. And David had had friendly links with this country during his own lifetime. He had sent his parents there to keep them safe temporarily when King Saul had been particularly troublesome in Israel. But what's plain from this chapter is that despite these friendly links at points, the Moabites were still trouble. They were still aggressive. They were still a threat to Israel. Centuries earlier, during the march into their country from Egypt, the Israelites had had to pass through Moab. And then the Moabites had felt intimidated. They'd felt worried by this arriving nation. As a result, their king, the king of the Moabites, had called on a man called Balaam to curse these Israelites. Now, Balaam failed to do it because God stopped him. So instead, the Moabites tried something different. They tried leading the Israelites astray, corrupting them. They used some of their women to tempt the Israelites to get involved in all their false worship, all their idol worship. They got them to get involved in immorality, to corrupt them, to lead them astray. At other times, the Moabites were so scared of the Israelites, they joined with other nations like the Ammonites and the Amalekites in order to attack Israel and oppress them. These people have been so troublesome that in the end, the only way the Israelites managed to sort of throw off the trouble for a while was actually to annihilate their whole army. We're told in the book of Judges that at one point, a Moabite army of, I think it's 10,000, were all killed. They simply had to be wiped out to prevent further trouble. But the trouble returned. By David's time, the Moabites were there again. They were threatening, they were dangerous. And if Israel was going to have any peace, something very clear, very decisive had to be done. Now, David had the upper hand. His powerful army overcame the Moabites, but then he had a dilemma. If he just let them go home, if he said, okay, you've lost, you go home, what would happen? If these people weren't punished, if these people weren't dealt with, what would happen? David knew that trouble would come back again. David knew from God that it's right to punish those who are doing wrong, and to punish them justly, to punish them appropriately according to their crimes, but also that punishment can be very severe, because sin, because wrongdoing is very wrong, very ugly in God's sight, and deserves great punishment. For these Moabites to keep stealing and killing and raiding Israel, attacking the people of God, was a crime which God said deserved death. It was that serious. David did punish them with death. He couldn't have done anything any other way. If there was going to be peace along that border, he couldn't just manage these aggressive people. He had to deal with them. Remember also that these were days where the military weapons available were only as good as the number of people you had. There were no long-range missiles, no bomber aircraft. Whatever types of spears and swords and catapults and slings you had, however advanced your technology, the number of soldiers you had on the ground in the end was the key factor. And so as David thought about that, and as David thought about the punishment of those who oppose God, he decided that he must take strong action against the Moabites. And we're told what he did. He captured their men, and he divided them up, and two-thirds were executed. David didn't go as far as the day of the judges. He didn't annihilate the whole army, but two-thirds died. Now remember, David isn't just trying to build an empire for himself. David isn't just showing how hard and tough he is. David is bringing peace to Israel. He is subduing the Moabites, not to make a name for himself, not to make himself rich. He is punishing those who have tried to attack and hurt his country, his people, God's people. And David wants to bring peace to those people. And that's the action he takes against the Moabites. But then he has to move on to elsewhere. And the next place he goes to fight is right up in the north of Israel now. He's fought in the bottom left and right corners. Now he goes to the north of the country. And this time he's up against a man called Hadadezer, who's the king of Zobah. And the notable thing about this opponent is that this army had war chariots. They were fast moving. They were dangerous. War chariots were an important weapon in those days to have. And David manages to overcome them. He captures both the foot soldiers and the chariots. Now, what would you do in that situation? If David was wanting to build a great empire for himself, if he was wanting to invade all these other countries and extend out his power everywhere, what would you do if you captured chariots? You'd expand your own military force, wouldn't you? If you were commanding an army and you found suddenly that an entire tank regiment fell into your hands, you would use them for yourself. You'd put your own men in them. You'd extend the power of your army. And especially if you were looking to build yourself up, if you were looking to be the important king of that area. And yet we don't find David did that at all. We find that what he does is he cripples the horses that pull the chariots, so they become worthless. Without fast-moving horses to pull them, these chariots are little more than small carts. And their military value is completely deflated. David does that because his great concern is not himself, not to become the great king, the great emperor, the great ruler. He is concerned with one thing: to bring peace to his people, to the people of Israel. He wants a border where there is peace, where there is no aggression, where there is no trouble. He wants to ensure that those who want to harm Israel are so brought down that they can cause no more difficulty. What could have happened if David had kept these chariots? Well, maybe next time he would have been the one who lost the battle. And then the chariots would have gone back into another army. And the whole cycle of violence would have carried on. By hanging on to the chariots, David could have set himself up with problems further down the road. But what David wants is peace. Peace for his people. He wants the borders secure. He wants them safe. So he needs an army that's strong, that's skilled, that's well armed. But But he's not looking to build himself up a great campaigning army, an empire building army. He's not stirred up with great thoughts of success and his own glory and his own praise. David, the king of Israel, is concerned with one thing: peace for his people. But having succeeded in the north, David then found there was another army marching across the horizon, the Arameans, coming from the northeast. Seeing the harm that David was inflicted on Hadadezer, the generals of Aram, a neighbouring kingdom, decide to come to his aid. They decide to try and beat down this king David. We don't know their motives. We don't know if it was because they were friendly towards Hadadezer or whether they just felt threatened themselves. But either way, David finds that another large army engages with his own. He's fighting again. And once again, David succeeds. He wins victory over the men of Damascus. 22,000 of them lose their lives. This time, he feels that he has to take extra action to secure the peace. It's not just enough to defeat that army. It's not just enough to cripple their military power, like he did with Moab, like he did with Zobah. This time David has to commit long-term resources. He has to put garrisons of soldiers through their region, peacekeepers, to maintain the peace and to ensure there's no more mischief-making in that area. Do you see the picture? You've got this little country, and on front after front, David found himself battling to secure this land for his people in the north, in the northeast, in the southeast, in the southwest. David had to win overwhelming victories, definitive defeats. And it had to be that way if he was going to secure the land. On each front, David needed to fight and win completely so that more trouble and problems wouldn't flare up for a long time. But how did he manage it in such a small land? And that's where we come back to verse 6. It was the Lord who gave David victory wherever he went. God had made this promise. He said to David that Israel would be a peaceful and a secure and a safe place to live. And here we're seeing how God brought that about. Through David, through his king, he did secure all the borders and he brought peace and security into that land. So that was thousands of years ago. What does that have to do with us? As Christians, we believe that attitude we see from God continues to be the attitude he has towards us. Not just to the people then, but to us. We're no longer limited to a particular piece of land like the Israelites. God has people, Christians, all across the world now. You find them in nations and countries in all places. Scattered. But wherever you meet a Christian, wherever you find someone who is one of the children of God, you are meeting someone who is living secure because they are living with the promise of God and they are living under the care of God's King. It's as though you had, let's say, an Israelite who was right slap bang in the middle of the country and he knew all the stories from all the years before and there was always that nervous feeling. When will the next raid come? Will it be the Midianites? Will it be the Philistines? Will it be the Amalekites? Who's going to break into the country next? And then David systematically smashes each force so that peace comes to the land. And the Israelites can just get on with their lives and live. And a Christian is someone who lives in this world and lives with that sort of peace. Lives knowing that they are safe. Lives knowing that they have a king who is protecting them. As really as David protected the Israelites who lived in their land. We are much like the Israelites. There are many enemies who are still opposed to God and opposed to the people of God and cause them trouble. And Christians, if they just looked at themselves, just like us this evening, we'd feel ourselves to be very small, very vulnerable. And the opposition that surrounds us is great. One of the enemies of the Christian church is the world. The world is always looking to break into the church, to impose its control, its rule over the people of God. The weapons it uses are different in different circumstances. You go to one country, a country, let's say, like China, and there the world will use weapons of aggression and violence. So Christians are persecuted physically. They have laws making them illegal. And they hold services like this until soldiers kick the doors in and break it up. And they have policemen who arrest Christian leaders and smash their bones with bamboo sticks. They are imprisoned, they're tortured, they're killed. Believers are prosecuted, believers are criminalised. You go to another country, and there the world might use weapons of economic pressure and social pressure. Christians are a lower class, less able to live, less able to earn money, because they're outside of normal society. They're branded as unacceptable or weird, the views they hold, the things they do. They're pushed to the margins so they struggle to survive. They're told not to cause trouble or else. Maybe you'll find that in a country that's dominated by Islam. Maybe they'll accept that Christians live there, but those Christians aren't a part of the country. They're marginalised. In another country, the world may use moral and philosophical pressure. Okay, Christians can live there freely, they're not attacked physically, they're not beaten up, they're not arrested. But just everybody knows that they're out of touch and out of date. Their beliefs are just crude or stupid or wicked. Their attitudes are old-fashioned or prudish or abnormal. They live feeble lives, having to have this crutch of a God they believe in. They can be mocked. You don't have to take them seriously. You can tell jokes about them. The world attacks God's people and tries to take control of them. And Christians feel like giving in to those pressures. I mean, who wouldn't? Who wants to be beaten up? Who wants their children to be taken away? Who wants to live as a pauper or an outcast? Who wants to feel as though they're stupid and forever defending something that's indefensible? Who wants to feel that they're in a tiny, ignorant minority and irrelevant to those round about? None of us do. The invasion force of the world has real power to terrify us. But God tells us to look to our King. Jesus Christ is the King of the people of God, and he keeps those people, he keeps us safe. If we start looking anywhere else for sort of security and safety, then we might as well give up. Once we've given up on God's King, we've given up on God. But the promises of God's kindness and goodness are there for those who don't give up. For those who go to the one place where God has promised these good things of safety, of security, of peace in life and forever. The one place God has said these things can be found are in his King, Jesus. God chose him, God appointed him to care for his people. We look to Jesus Christ if we want to live safely in this world. We ask, how did he live? We ask, what attitudes did he take? How did he cope? And then we pray and we ask him to help us to do the same. As it were, we have already watched King David, riding off into battle, leading the way. Jesus has already engaged with the battle with the world and driven back the enemy. And we just follow in his path, knowing the protection of him and the peace that he's brought. But like Israel, we find there's danger not just on one border. It's not just the world. We need protection from other directions. There is an unseen enemy who attacks Christians. He attacks us through our minds. He attacks us through our hearts. Satan, the accuser, the slanderer, the tempter, the devil. The one that people say is just an imaginary idea, a little red man with horns. And in fact, he is a force for evil. He wants to strike into our souls. He comes against us through another border. For one believer, he's trying to convince them that they can't be a Christian. Their sins are too many. Their failures are constant. They're unworthy of God. With a different Christian, he spins their mind around in dark thoughts, lies and deceits. They misjudge fellow believers. They see problems and troubles in the church. Their relationships with other Christians break down. They feel confused. They feel unsure. He attacks another Christian by undermining their faith. How can they believe these things they say they believe? How can they know it's true? Where's the proof? He insinuates doubts and questions to lead them off the path. For another Christian, he's going at them with temptations. Look, it would be easier if you just gave in to that desire. Why are you bothering with all these rules, these commandments from God? Isn't it time to put yourself first? Have what you want. Satan attacks the church. He tries to take control. And Christians feel as though that pressure is too much. What Christian, when they honestly look at themselves, doesn't feel unworthy to be called a child of God? What Christian doesn't at points start to distrust other believers and become negative when things go wrong? What Christian at times doesn't question whether all this is true after all? When they're confronted with something which eats into them emotionally or mentally, a crisis, a personal crisis, or a crisis in the world. What Christian doesn't feel at times that temptation is too much to bear? It's easier just to give in, let it roll over us. What can help against this enemy? We look to our King. Jesus Christ will fight for his people and keep them safe. If we resist Satan, confident in our own strength, in our own ability to sort of stand up to him, then we're knocked down in a moment. We resist him as a part of our King's army, knowing it's the King who will get the victory, who will make us secure. Are you praying every day for protection against this unseen enemy? Are you wanting every day to hear the King's orders, how to stay safe in the campaign? Are you looking every day at how the King waged war and won? It's your only hope if you are a believer. As Christians, we are faced with different enemies who try to defeat us. We've not talked about sin. That's another enemy. We've not talked about death. That's another enemy. And each one of these enemies is wanting to invade the lives of believers and control them and control the church. And destroy the kingdom that Jesus rules over. They come from different directions. They come at different times. Enemies on the borders of our lives threatening to destroy our positions as the people of God. But the King fights for us and makes us secure. And our King will win the final victory over all of these things. In the end, there will be no enemy left with the power to cause trouble of any sort to the people of God. Our King will take whatever decisive action is necessary, utterly to strip away the power from all our enemies and to bring us eternal peace. Is there a great unseen evil spirit who tries to harm us? Is he bigger than we can imagine, cleverer, more able to do things that we can think of? Christ says, I will take that spirit and he will burn. He will be gone. Is there a world that hates Christians and causes all sorts of trouble and tries to drive Christians out of their kingdom? The king says, one day I will take that world and I will destroy it and it will be gone. Every enemy, everything and everybody who stands opposed to God, who lives without God, who says, I don't care about God, he's not for me, I will do things my way. Whether it's a great unseen spirit or just somebody ordinary in the street, if they are going to stand against the king that God has given, that king will defeat them and they shall lose. But he does it not so that he can boast, not so that he can say how powerful he is. He does it because he wants all enemies of God to be gone and peace, eternal peace, to be given to the people of God. Do you hope for peace? Is that what you're wanting? Is that what you've found? Are you safe from all your enemies? Or do you find yourself unsafe because you're actually still on their side, opposed to God? There are only two sides in the great war of the universe. There are those who are for the King, Jesus Christ, and those who are against. Those who will win, those who will lose. God's King will destroy all his enemies. You cannot stand against God and hope to succeed. You can't do it. You cannot stand against the mightiest power in the universe and say, I'll do what I want, and think you will win. You won't. If the power of the sea can wash away 150,000 human beings in a moment, what do you think the power of the one who made the sea can do? But this God and his king say, come and live in this kingdom and be safe. He asks you to join him. If you want to be saved from these enemies, if you want to live out your days not fearful of their power, and if you want to be on the side that will win, you go to Jesus Christ. He is the saviour. He's the rescuer. He can save you from all of these dangers we've talked about. And the anger of God, he can save. You can come and live in peace. No matter who you are, Jesus Christ is the King who can save anyone if they put their trust in him. You can be safe. You can rely upon him completely. You need have no fears. You go to God's King. You live safe and secure, protected from danger forever. And the reason you can particularly rely on him, the reason you can place so much trust and faith in this King, is because his motivation is not to build himself an empire, not to build himself a great name. His great motivation is to bring peace and safety to his people. You can trust him because he is a king who loves his people. It's interesting, even in this chapter, you know, we see something of that in David. We read in the second part of how David defeats all these enemies. And of course, there's a lot of riches to be found when you defeat enemies, aren't there? He finds golden shields, and he finds bronze, and he gets silver, and he gets gold, and into David's kingdom flows all this money and all these riches. And then other kings come along, and they want to befriend David, And they say, well, let us give you gifts. We'll give you gold. We'll give you silver. And there's David. He could become so rich, so wealthy. It could all be for him. Not only could he have the great name as the great emperor of that part of the Middle East, but he could be rich beyond his dreams. And David, it says, dedicated all these articles to the Lord. Silver and gold came flowing into his kingdom, it says, from Edom, Moab, Ammon, Philistia, and Amalek. He could have made his fortune, but he dedicated it all to his God. David recognized the success that was given to him was not for his benefit, but for the honor and glory of God. Land was taken in order to create a peaceful place where God's people could live. And David gathered all these riches in order to give them to God so that God's temple could be built one day in the midst of that peaceful land. In other words, we look at David and we say, what's driving him? What's his motivation? Why is he fighting these wars? And we see he does it for God's people and he does it for God. Not for himself. There's no self-centeredness, no selfish ambition. He is driven by love for God's people and love for God. And that is the character of all God's kings. And that is the character of God's final king, Jesus Christ. When we look at Jesus and we say, well, why should I trust him? Maybe he's got some secret motive. Maybe he's got some own reason for having people becoming Christians. We say there is no secret motive. It's all open. He lives for his God and he lives and dies for the good of his God's people. He lives and works with God on his mind, not himself. He is utterly other person-centered in all his living. And because of that devotion to God, he is willing to give himself in whatever way necessary to rescue his people. And that's why he can be absolutely relied upon. No corrupt motives inside of him, no questions you need to ask, nothing to distrust. The great King, Jesus Christ, selflessly has given himself to save those who will trust in him. This chapter is all about the fulfilling of the promises of God. God has said to David that he would create such a land. He said to David that he would build a temple in that land one day. And God is doing that, but he does it through David himself. He does keep his promises, and he does it through his king. Won't you come and trust this king for yourself if you haven't done already? Not David now, he's dead and in his tomb, but the other king we've been talking about, Jesus Christ. Don't you want to live secure, at peace? Only with God's king can you do that. Don't you want to have someone you can trust, whose motivation you can be absolutely sure about? Never for a moment will you have to question why he does this for you. That is God's King, Jesus Christ. Don't you want a king who has all the power of the living God backing up what he does? Who gave David victory? The Lord gave David victory. He defeated powerful armies. He defeated the great chariots of the north and the armies of the south because God backed him up. Jesus Christ not only has God backing him up, he is the Son of God. He is the King with God's own power in his hands. Don't you want to have a king like that, one you can trust absolutely and know that he can do everything he promises. No promise will fail. The Lord Jesus Christ is the King whom God has sent. He sent him to bring peace to his people, to rescue them from their enemies, to make them secure forever. Go to him this night and place your trust in him.